This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live. There was a time when going to Athens must have seemed like a really good idea.
Yeah, it's that with Nolan, I think, isn't it? I went on holiday by mistake. But I got back. I mean, I have to say that the BBC leapt into action. There were plans that I could do the show down the line from Athens.
Radio Thessalonica?
Yeah, and I pointed out that the problem was that it wasn't the doing the show down the line, it was the seeing the films in advance. And you'd be amazed how many people said, do you have to do that? Couldn't you just, but not okay. Internally, you know, externally. People say, so I was with a group of people, they said, well, if you can do it down the line, do it. And I said, yeah, but I have to see the films. They went, do you? You just make it up.
Such an old-fashioned view.
I know. Actually, watch the films? How's that going to work?
We are both being live-streamed. If you go to the website, you can click the obvious buttons and you can watch the fun.
I was live-streamed from Athens on is it called Skype? Mm-hmm. I was in an internet cafe talking down a Skype connection. And it looked like some David Lynch experimental film. It was a weird guy with glasses talking backwards. I said, like, I am the arm. And
that was
I
you.
Sound like, yeah, me.
John Catterfield, somewhere along the embankment. Dear Steve and Seb, welcome back. Big fan of the show, Steve. More specifically, the podcast. And listen every Monday on my way to work. This week, apparently, is going to be different. On Sunday, I, like thousands of others, will be running the London Marathon and have been watching all the classics, The Running Man, Run, Fat Boy Run, and Nuns on the Run, as inspiration. I fear, however, none of the cinematic masterpieces will give me the mental boost that I need for those last hard 6 miles, which is where you come in. Mm-hmm. I will be listening to your podcast during the race, somewhere between miles 20 and 26, and respectfully ask if, from your comfy seats, you could give myself and many others an energy-filling shout-out along the lines of, come on, you can do it, or not far to go now.
Okay.
Failing that, a conventional well done will suffice.
Okay. Come on, you can do it. Not far to go now. What is it they do in... have you ever seen An Officer and a Gentleman?
Of course.
Yeah, that thing...
Mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise, yes. But they sing all those inappropriate songs as they're doing army. Apparently, that's how they train the army. They make them run along swearing.
John Catterfield, come on.
Yes.
Show a bit of effort. Slacker.
That's what they do. Catterfield at the back. Going to miss the coach home, boy.
And if you need the loo, you can't go in the middle of the road.
Jason Isaacs is stuck in Chicago.
What a terrible thing.
Yes.
I'm sure he's passing the time splendidly.
Probably by the time he gets this, he'll be unstuck. But hello to Jason, also under the volcanic cloud.
Andy Gibbons says, I just bumped into Mark at a Robin Hood screening, and I told him about message that
this
I sent his way a couple of months ago.
This is true. He's a film critic, yeah.
Who's he critic for, then?
Well, he writes for many people. He's not tied down.
Peripatetic reviewer. I had the pleasure of interviewing Pierre Morel today about his upcoming movie From Paris with Love. Remind us about Pierre Morel.
From Paris with Love is the one with John Travolta and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, and it's terrible. But Pierre Morel is, should we call him a journeyman, jobbing workman-like director? But the thing that he did
brackets not very good.
No. That doesn't mean
jobbing
that at all.
Journeyman doesn't imply great skill.
It means that he doesn't have distinct. I think there are probably things that you could look at and go, that's a Pierre. If there are four cars crashing into each other with but he was involved in Taken, the Liam Neeson.
Yeah, I can't be bothered to answer your questions. Him, right? So he did Taken. So anyway, so here is Andy, and he's interviewing Pierre Morel. During this interview, I managed to ask him who was in control of the boat while Liam Neeson was killing anything that moved at the end of Taken. He seemed both amused and bemused by the question, but was very happy to answer. He explained that while all the bodyguards engaged Neeson's furious father figure, the captain and crew professionally stayed at their posts. It simply wasn't their fight. I hope this answers one of contemporary cinema's most puzzling of questions.
Well, that doesn't add up, right? Because for a start, as we discussed when he said this, I said, well, of course, it was pointed out to me, it doesn't he actually off a few members of the crew as he gets onto the boat, in which case it is their fight? And secondly, even if it isn't their fight, do you not think the captain driving the boat would think, hang about, there's an awful lot of semi-automatic weaponry fire going on just down below me, perhaps I had better stop and see what's going on? Do you actually think this? And they go, no, that's not my job. I think the honest truth of it is, as Pierre has now effectively admitted, they didn't think it through.
Tom in Johannesburg, dear Porky Pig and Kevin Bacon, after seeing the trailer to James, is it Nguyen?
Mm-hmm.
James, Nguyen's diabolic pick, Birdemic, and reading some online reviews, I thought I would like to ask the good doctor whether he's seen this piece of rubbernecking cinema. Could it be the worst film ever made?
Haven't seen it. What's it called?
Birdemic.
Spell it for me.
Bird, and then emic.
Was it is it two words, or is there a word?
It's Birdemic. One word. It could be Birdemic.
Birdemic.
It's going to be unlikely.
Wasn't that Bix Beiderbecke's brother? Bix Beiderbecke and his brother Birdemic.
But you haven't seen it?
No.
Worst film you've ever seen is what he's asking.
Well, Oversexed Rugsuckers from Mars or Exorcist II, The Heretic. If you're counting, I mean, actually worst ever made, Oversexed Rugsuckers from Mars, because it is incredibly badly made. Actually worst film, Exorcist II, The Heretic. You know, loads and loads of dollars and huge special effects and Richard Burton and Louise Fletcher and Kitty Wynn and Linda Blair and stinks.
Brian Steele, a Scot living in Grasse in France. Dear Faldo and Caddy, I live near Mark's favourite town of Cannes. We get to see a few UK releases in version originale, such as Le Chèvre du Pentagon. Would you say that?
I said Le Chèvre du Pentagon. No, hang on. You don't mean
with George Clooney, an education.
Hang on. Le Chèvre du Pentagon with George Clooney. What is that? Is that up in the air?
Yes, must be.
Is it? What's it
got to do with the Pentagon, though?
Oh no, Le Chèvre du Pentagon. The chef of the Pentagon.
Chèvre.
Is that cheese? Isn't it? No, what's chèvre?
It's big cheese. Must be big cheese.
Big cheese.
Big cheese at the Pentagon.
It's Dr. Strangelove. That's what it is.
An education.
Education, which I have seen now. Thank you. Stop asking if I have.
Alice au Pays des Merveilles.
That would be Alice in Wonderland in 3D.
Watching, yes, absolutely.
What's 3D in French? Trois, deux. No.
Day.
Day. Trois day.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Watching Alice with the 3D glasses gave me a headache, therefore I was glad to be seeing a non-3D film, Green Zone, this evening. However, all was not well. I was subjected to shaky camera overkill, an increasing green grass trait. In the Bourne films, we got the occasional break from fast-cut shakiness to have Steadicam large helicopter shots of large train stations and other scene-setting stuff. I'm hoping that Mr. Greengrass is never persuaded to make Bourne 4 or any other film with similar shake-and-vac camera work in 3D. Otherwise, I really will be physically sick.
What's French for grass? Oh, come on.
I apologise now to my mother if she's listening, because she's a French teacher.
Is she? Simon doesn't know the French for grass, and his mum teaches French. He's rubbish. No, so because I was trying to pull Greengrass.
It's coming to me slowly.
What is... No, nobody in there. They don't know either. A bunch of Philistines.
Grass in French, obviously. Are you saying that you really don't know?
Yeah, no, yes. Really? I don't. I honestly don't know what grass in French is. What is it?
Well...
You don't know either.
I can't believe.
I bet you either of our guests, or indeed both of our guests, will know what the French for grass is. So what's Paul Greengrass's green zone in French?
Is it? I think it's herbe.
Herbe. Is it herbe? Isn't that something in a Bob Marley song?
Well, it could well be, but okay. I think it's...
L'herbe de verte.
Can't be that.
Un film de Paul...
Can't be right.
L'herbe de verte.
Email from Jeremy Dillon. You know, he's age 20. He's in Sydney, Australia. Always exciting to... He says, Dear Fry and Laurie, always exciting to hear about a new David Morrissey film coming up on Wintertainment. I'm currently negotiating with David on Twitter, where he's demanding that he'll play all the penguins in my Benjamin's Little Grass and the Cauldron of Penguins movie, despite Jason Isaacs having first dibs on the role. Whatever am I to do?
Well, that's... Actually, maybe we could have a playoff tennis match between David Morrissey and Jason Isaacs, because there was going to be some tennis thing that we were going to do, and we were going to be ball boys, but it didn't happen.
I don't know what happened to that.
Well, it didn't happen is what happened to
Tom
it.
Tom Button on Twitter, at the cinema last night, they said to report people for copying films. Yeah. Can I report Mr. Bay for Nightmare on Elm Street?
Yay!
That works.
There was a guy called Charles Band who used to make films very much. He was in many ways the forerunner of Luc Besson, and he was like a stable. If it said Charles Band, all the films would open up were based on an original idea by Charles Band, to which everyone would say with one voice, Charles Band has never had an original idea in his life.
Yes, I agree with that. Birdemic. Or
Birdemic.
This is
Birdemic by Becker.
Tom in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. Apparently. Is this from... it's from the Internet Movie Database, I think. A platoon of eagle and vultures attack the residents of a small town. Many people died. It's not known what caused the flying menace to attack. Two people fight back, but will they survive? The Birdemic.
That's the birds, though, isn't it?
It does sound remarkably similar to the birds, just slightly more specifically, just eagles and vultures, which you would imagine be slightly more scary than the small birds featured in Birds.
No, but that's the thing that's really scary about the birds, is that it's just, you know, is it the birds themselves don't seem menacing until they become, you know, until they become cross. Or
and of course,
yes.
Chèvre is goats.
Chèvre is goat. Okay, so
the Chèvre de Pontagon is obviously.
It's the men who stare at goats.
Les hommes qui va.
No, not va. That's go. That's the men who go to the goats. What's vieux? Is goat it vieux? No, that's the Warner Cinema, isn't it? The vieux West End. What's the French for sea? L'oiseau. No, les yeux. Eyes. Les hommes qui avaient les yeux pour la chèvre. Now, the men who have the eyes for the goats.
But the French version is the goats of the Pentagon. The Pentagon goats. Les chèvres de Pentagon.
But that doesn't work.
It doesn't.
That doesn't work at all.
The Pentagon goats.
That just sounds like an American football team.
Or a Cayley band. Mike Harding tonight at 7 o'clock with Les Chèvres de Pentagon. That's 2:16. So we need to talk about some new movies, of course, okay, as opposed to Birdemic. So remind us what we're doing. So date night and extract, and we have a couple of big guests, a couple of big directors coming in.
Can I do that now?
Why don't you do that?
Yeah. Okay, so we've got Gurinder Chadha coming in to talk about...
Any minute now.
She'll be coming in to talk about It's a Wonderful Afterlife and to Correct Your French, followed by Neil Marshall, who is coming in to talk about Centurion. And I'm going to get him to do it in original Roman, or Latin, as I believe they called it back then.
Gurinder Chadha is here. Hello, Gurinder, how are you?
Hi, Simon. Very good, thank you.
Just to tick these off the list, worst film you've ever seen? We're just talking about Birdemic, which is Birdemic. It's being suggested as a terrible film.
Oh, my goodness me. Oh, no, you put me on the spot. There's been tons.
Choose any one.
Okay.
Let's narrow it down genre by genre then. What's the kind of sort of film you don't like?
I just don't like films that don't hang together, where the storytelling's not there. And I mean, I don't mind someone making a film that I didn't particularly like because I didn't like the story, as long as it was made well. I mean, I think if a director's intentions are good and they've plied their craft as best as they can, I don't mind. I just think sloppy films that don't make any sense are no good.
Right, so cut to the chase. Name a bad film that you've seen.
Oh, my God, I wish you'd tell me this before.
Like, no, that would involve planning. Don't do that.
A bad film.
Any film that you've seen that you haven't liked?
In the last, say, decade or two.
God, it's very hard, right?
Oh,
because I'm a director.
No, it's not hard. Slag somebody off. Wasn't it you who said to me, we were at the BAFTAs a couple of years ago, and you came by the table and you touched me on the shoulder and you said, it must be really hard being in a room with everyone that you've slagged off.
Yes, but that's because you're not a director, you're a critic.
Oh, that's what I was getting wrong. There we go.
Do you like... Okay, well, look, we'll come... I'm not going to let you off.
You need to come up with that.
Oh, I need to think about something.
Yeah. 3D. Love it? Hate it?
Yes, love it. I think it's... but hold on a minute. I don't like the big... I think 3D is good for story. If you use it for proper storytelling, I think it's very good in terms of enhancing the cinema experience. But you cannot just rely on the effects of 3D. You need to marry it with good storytelling.
Give me an example of a film that has used 3D well for storytelling.
Avatar. Not yet. Hasn't happened yet.
Avatar.
Hasn't happened yet, but the technology we can't ignore, and I think we need to.
No, but that's interesting. So what you're saying is 3D is great for storytelling in cinema, but no one's done it yet.
No, because we've just been introduced to it on a massive scale.
The first 3D patent was filed.
Avatar,
stop saying Avatar.
Well, Avatar.
Do you know when the first 3D patent for moving pictures was?
Yeah.
1896.
Oh, right.
So they've had over 100 years to have a crack at it.
Well,
Avatar.
And also the new dance movie, Street Dance, is it? Vertigo?
Street Dance in 3D.
Right, because that was just going to be a straightforward movie, and I think people just thought, oh, it's nothing much, and then they turned it into 3D.
They retrofitted it.
And actually, it's apparently, everyone in the business says it's going to do really well.
Because he kept saying Avatar, just like a stuck record, just
Avatar.
Said it all the way, like, while we were having it, just said Avatar, Avatar, Avatar. On Monday, Avatar comes out on DVD in 2D, and I've seen it in 3D in the cinema, and 2D on video, and you know what? It's better in 2D. On 2D, there are things about it that you get to see and appreciate, which I didn't whilst watching it in 3D. I mean, I still think it's fundamentally flawed, but I think its heart is in the right place, and I much more enjoyed it on 2D on a flat screen than I did in 3D. And I think the whole idea that the 3D thing is what makes Avatar work for the people that really like it is completely bogus.
Okay, I'm bored with that now. So let's
talk
about
with it for months.
Let's talk about Gurinder's film. Actually, just before we talk about Gurinder's film, titles that are translated into French and then lose something.
Yeah.
We were stuck on Les Chèvres de Pentagon.
The Pentagon. You know what that is?
The men who stare at goats, which they've translated
really
it as
is.
The Pentagon's goats.
Oh, no, that doesn't work.
Guy in Twickenham says, in France, Jaws was called The Teeth of the Sea.
La Dent de la Mer. La Dent de la Mer. That's exactly that is what it is. Yeah. Yes.
Jaws 2, he said, would have been called Les Dents de la Mer Part 2. But, as in French, that sounds like Teeth of the Poo.
So, yes.
They called... So you couldn't say Les Dents de la Mer 2.
Did you know that in Spain, the Nova car is not called Nova because Nova means don't go?
Ah.
Thanks for that.
What's Spend It Like Beckham in French?
I was just going to say, Joue comme la Beckham.
Joue comme la Beckham. Comme la means, but okay. means
play.
Play like Beckham.
But it actually means, in French, it means, yeah, bring it on like Beckham. Come on.
So what about It's a Wonderful Afterlife? Because it's a sort of a, it's a reasonable, it's a play on
Yes,
play
I
on
guess title, whatever the Frank Capra movie is in French.
It's probably called Bingy it'll Bong. Be it'll be one of those things that they don't translate, won't it?
It's Bindy Bong too.
Yeah. Did you know that the Chinese version of A Star is Born is called Bitter Tears, A Little Singing Star? So it's a Wonderful Life. Probably isn't called It's a Wonderful Life.
It'll have India in the title because they're real Indophiles in France. As they do that, it'll be fine.
Gurinder is here because her new movie is It's a Wonderful Afterlife. So we'll play a little clip in a moment. Just set it up for us first, Gurinder. Tell us what's happening in your new movie.
New movie, comedy, supernatural comedy. First British Asian popcorn movie, I would say. It is about an Indian mother who has a daughter that's a little bit fat, a little bit ugly, broken engagement.
Except she isn't fat or ugly.
She is.
She isn't.
She's a size 16.
She's well,
and most women are 8, aren't they?
Really?
Movies.
In what world
in
is
movies,
that?
In movies, in the movie screen. Basically, she really wants her daughter to be happy and not die unmarried and die not being a mother. So people in the community are very mean about this girl, and the mother's had enough, and so she starts bumping them off.
And
but they don't die, they come back. Because we believe in reincarnation. And the ghosts don't understand why they haven't been reincarnated. And various plot devices lead to the fact that in order to move on to the next life, they have to do good deeds. And the good deed they have to do is help get the fat girl happily married.
So the reincarnation bit is probably one of the bits that has never been done before in this kind of Ealing-style comedy. Would that be right?
Yes, although I did reference Blythe Spirit.
Blythe Spirit, yeah.
Which was not reincarnation, that was just ghosts.
So I return to my original statement then.
Yes, okay. You do, yes.
by the way, Wonderful Life in French was La Vie est Belle.
Oh.
So La Après-Vie est Belle.
Oh, yes.
Bon. Does that work?
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's your new movie. We've given you the title there.
Oh,
here's a clip. Here's a clip from Gurinder's new movie, It's a Wonderful Afterlife.
I'm just saying... If you were wanting to get married, then
Mom! If we're going to go on walks together, it's a marriage-free zone. Ask me about work, where I want to travel, who I'm voting for, anything except for marriage all the time. Of course, I'd like to meet someone. I'm not as beautiful as Linda.
And that's why we're doomed.
You know, there's nothing wrong with being single. A lot of women are happy that way their whole life.
Oh.
Oh, God.
Now we are truly in purgatory.
Chop, chop, chop. Mrs. Sethi, you're worse than my wife. It is your duty to find her a husband now. We should take her to a marriage bureau. That is the fastest way.
That didn't do very much for our daughter, did it, huh?
I'm not going to interfere. I have told her.
Mom, who are you talking to?
Yeah, there were some squelchy sound effects in the middle of that. What happened? And then various kind of... So what's happening there?
Well, basically, everyone she kills using sort of Indian food methods. And in a nod to American Werewolf in London, each of these spirits are disintegrating as time progresses. And bits of them fall out and fall apart and squelch around.
So the first squelchy was somebody's insides. I mean, the second one was because he's been suffocated with a chapati dough.
Yeah,
and that was finally coming out.
His dough falls off.
Quite interesting to compare and contrast the assorted means of killing people in our two movies today. It's a Wonderful Afterlife and Centurion.
Oh. Yeah, no one is killed with chapati dough in Centurion.
I missed that one.
Best of my knowledge.
No. Mostly decapitation, as I recall.
With steel, but we have a woman who's been stabbed through the neck with a steel kebab skewer with tandoori chicken on it.
For comedy purposes.
But because because of the food theme through all the deaths, there was a question about whether somebody was saying, because you know that Shaun of the Dead was rom-zom-com.
Yeah.
So can you call this rom-zom-popadom-com? Can you? I don't know.
How long? You've had a long flight to work. Yeah.
Korma Blimey.
That joke, incidentally, copyright Nigel Floyd. Yeah, Korma Blimey, there we go. Very good.
Korma Blimey's on the poster, isn't it?
It's in the thing, yeah. Because it's a film about naan slaughter.
So, before, I would ask you more about the assorted methods of murder, but tell us about Shabana Azmi, this Bollywood legend. So just explain her role and why you got her.
The mum is played by Shabana Azmi, who is the Meryl Streep of India. And she was in a British movie. She was in Madame Szaszka by John Schlesinger many years ago. And she was in this film called Fire by Deepa Mehta a few years back. But basically, she is very, very revered in India and is normally a very serious sort of art house actress. And she's also a politician and she's a big activist. She's always taken to the street with all kinds of issues. So this is a very different departure for her. Comedy, British, Asian, not very glamorous mum.
And she wants to bump all these people off because...
Because they've been rude to her daughter. About her daughter.
They say her daughter's fat and ugly and unmarriageable and not suitable for their sons. So, you know, I think it's quite a reasonable thing to do.
Just to start bumping them off.
Yeah, because, you know, it's not fair. I mean, even fat girls deserve to get married, don't
they? But she's not fat.
She is fat. She's size 16. She's not huge.
Some of us,
she's not precious fat.
This is Goldie... Goldie Nate, is it?
Yes, Goldie Nate, yes.
And did she have to pile on a bit of weight?
Yes, she did. That's why I know she's fat. She put on 3 stone.
Yeah, I put on 3 stone to come here, but that doesn't mean I'm not...
That was just a week in Athens. That's all that was. Well, that was Sarka.
Goldie's a great comedy actress, and I saw her on the stage at Brentford, Waterman's in Brentford. And I do that. I mean, that's how I found Perminder Nagar as well in Bend It Like Beckham at the Oval, theatre production at the Oval. And that's how I like to do my casting, because I find the casting process just awful. I just get very tense because you have loads of people coming in and they see you as their, as the boundary between them and becoming Keira Knightley, say, you know. And so, you know, it's very disheartening, you know, to have lines of people coming in and reject them. So I like to go, I like to watch lots of things. I like to go to the theatre. I like to sort of just hear about what people are doing and watch them on YouTube and stuff like that.
That's quite interesting because usually when you hear directors talk about casting, it's, you know, we search the whole world and then right on the last day,
we're in a youth hostel in Penge.
Suddenly, in walked, you know, Mary Johnson. I think that's, we just knew instantly that it was her and she had to play the part. So it's quite, quite a struggle
and you don't like it.
We wrote the script with her in mind, a Goldie, and we wrote Beckham with Perminder in mind. So yeah, I think that I think directors do. I mean, I think you, when you watch a movie or you watch a show, you in the back of your head, you always have, you know, there's, if you connect with an actor, you're always thinking, yeah, one day, you know, I'll put them in a movie.
Okay, now we've got news and sport coming up, which usually lasts about 5 minutes, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, unless there's a lot of stuff going on.
Ask, is there a lot of stuff going on?
Not too much stuff going on.
Be short.
Okay, well, it'll be about 5 minutes. You've got 5 minutes to name a movie that you really, really would consider. There must be by a director who's dead or something. You're not going to upset.
And considering the company that you're in, it has to be a movie made by somebody who could still hear and be offended by disliking it. Otherwise,
just
it doesn't count.
Okay.
All right?
We have some movie conversation between now and 4 o'clock. Shortly, Neil Marshall is going to be with us to tell us about Centurion. Gurinder Chadha is here. It's a Wonderful Afterlife. And you had 4.5 minutes, as it turned out, to go and Google really rubbish movies. What have you come up with?
I've come up with two.
Hey!
Oh, okay. Two. Match Point.
Yeah, Match Point.
Very bad.
Match Point is rubbish.
Made worse because of the expectation of the great Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't hang together and he just got so caught up with the whole English mm-hmm. sort of Sloane Street kind of look. He just lost his way, I think.
Also, you can't decide what kind of movie it is because it starts out as one, and then there's a crime thriller, and then there's like, what?
Yeah.
Okay, that's one.
The other one was P.S. I Love You.
Yeah, which is rubbish.
But it was a really good script, and I wish I wanted to make that film.
What would you have done to it?
I wouldn't have made it so cheesy. It was very, very cheesy and very...
Rianda Fromage.
Yeah.
Who
Beaucoup.
Who wrote the script?
Richard Lagravanese.
So I mean, I've
and
seen
he made it.
I've seen the film, but I just remember it not being very good at all.
He sent me the script for a read, and I thought that it should have been made in a much more grittier style. But it was made in a classic Hollywood rom-com style. Had it been made in a more grittier style, it would have been much more moving, because it was about a woman whose husband dies. And then she can't get over the grief because he keeps writing to her. So it was a perfect premise for a romantic movie, but so many scripts are just ruined because they're fed into the sausage factory of genre, of one particular genre, and they lose all their originality.
And it's a decent
example.
It's a decent cast as well, because it stars
Amy, the boxer.
This is like anyway. Amy,
you know, the woman who played the boxer in the Clint Eastwood movie.
Hilary Swank.
And
we knew we'd get there in the end.
Creaky old brains are us.
Yes, sorry, it is.
And the gorgeous bloke
who's not fat either.
The one who was in Phantom of the Opera. He was the Phantom.
Michael Crawford.
No, no. The one with
he
the
was in Bounty
haircut.
Hunter just now with Jennifer Aniston.
Yes.
Lord.
Gerard Depardieu. Yes.
Yeah.
It was rubbish, though.
That was rubbish.
Classic piece of radio, that was. Just a bit bit more of Lost in Translation here on the title. Jean-Luc says, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels in France was crime, arnaque et botanique, which literally means crime, swindles and botanic. No wonder it didn't work very well in French. And Rob says, the most wonderful film, Le Fable Destin d'Amélie Poulain, becomes Boring Old Amélie in English. Right, it's not just the French who mess with the title.
That is quite right.
Actually, Pride and Prejudice in France, had a play on Notting Hill. Because Notting Hill in French was called Coeur de Fleur, I think. And they called Pride and Prejudice Coeur de Fleur de Bollywood.
No. Don't think that works.
It's not very good, is it?
Could you say this? A text says, Simon, could you say hello to Gorinda? I am the chap who dug the grave for her in the cemetery scene and had a blast on the day filming. Thank you, says Gary.
Thank you, Gary.
Do you want to explain what was going on there?
Yeah, we have in the film, Mrs. Setti has a Jewish neighbour, Mrs. Goldman, and they're in and out of each other's houses all the time. And Mrs. Goldman often comes in and brings over cake and takes whatever Mrs. Setti's made and has it. And unfortunately, at one point, Mrs. Setti's made some poisoned Indian sweets. And Mrs. Goldman comes in to pick up her cake tin and picks up one of the sweets. And the next thing we know is that she is like dead along with her little dog, and they both appear at the funeral as spirits, her and the dog. And
that's where the grave is, and
we're at the Jewish cemetery in Willesden, and Gary there was the spectacular grave digger.
We should also point out, in relation to the fact that Neil Marshall is coming in a bit, and of course is known for the horror, Here He Comes, so known for the horror genre, there is an entire, I don't think I'm giving too much away, there's an entire extended section towards the end of your movie in which you do Carrie.
Yes.
But, I mean, in quite some detail you do Carrie. It's not just like a throwaway joke, it's a whole 4 minute
it was 20 minutes but
we did the whole film.
Hello, Neil Marshall.
Hello.
You know each other, don't you?
I think we met on passing.
Yeah. You're in the child.
Yes, hello,
you're in the child of Neil Marshall.
Now, I want you to play Death Trumps, okay?
What?
So I want you to... Death Trumps,
like
okay?
So farting.
No. What I want you to do is to... Because there's a lot of death in both of your...
Yes.
Far more death in yours. I want you to go through assorted means of death in your comparative films. You can start, Neil. Just in terms of describing how people end their life on this earth, and then Gorinda can do one from her movie. But you have to go first.
Okay, my wife appears in the film and she gets an arrow stuck in her eye.
Gorinda.
I'll raise you to Sanjeev Bhaskar being fed extremely hot, hot curry and his stomach exploding alien style.
Well,
15 love.
There's like 3,000 Roman legions get hacked to pieces. So we've got quantity maybe over quality there.
Ah, okay, so
huge amount.
But how? Just explain. Oh. Give us the detail, and then Grinda can.
Well, it's called a war, Simon.
Yeah, it's a massacre. It's the 9th Legion get wiped out by the Picts. With burning fireballs and spears and axes.
Okay,
and,
burning, fireballs.
Burning fireballs.
Nasty, batty old woman, a meaner version of the mum in Bend It Like Beckham, gets stabbed through the neck with a kebab skewer with chicken tikka on it, which is made doubly worse because she's a vegetarian.
Right.
I didn't include the food in mine. That's,
that's what you're missing.
Remind me of the first death in Centurion. Compare with that one.
The first death of Centurion is...
gently described, please.
Gently described is basically this Roman guy gets a spear shoved right up into his groin.
I raise you to a bumbling cop, Hot Fuzz-style cop, who gets in the ghoulies with a pair of gardening shears.
Never thought of that, Marshall, did you?
No, I didn't do that one.
But what's so good about this is known for horror movies, known for comedy, and yet which one has the more depraved imagination?
These comedy directors you've got to watch out for.
Mine's comedy killing, and you don't really see any of the deaths except the last one.
Did it start as how it ended up? Was the original idea to make it slightly more horror based?
It started with the idea of doing an Indian wedding but turning it into the carry scene. It was a scene that I wish I could see. I mean, I really wanted to see that scene. And I thought no one was ever going to make that movie unless me. And then I've got millions of people around the world who so love Bend It Like Beckham that I cannot escape from that. And it's been 7 years since that movie. And so I thought, well, okay, let's do something back in the Asian community, but something totally different. So we went down the horror route, but I'm not really a horror fan, but I'm a big fan of spoofing movies, and we don't tend to do that here either in Britain. So I was trying to do something very different, kind of putting it Shaun of the Dead in the Asian community, but also spoofing Alien and Poltergeist and Carrie and American Werewolf in London. So it wasn't comedy horror.
If I can take you back to the beginning of that answer, because what you said was, because I always wanted to see Carrie as
always wanted to see an Indian, a scene like Carrie, but with Indians in it.
But for any... Why? I'm not going to ask the obvious question.
Because it had never been done.
And
it's not the way you imagine seeing the Indian community. And you have to remember, the way I came into this business was at a time when people like me were completely absent from the screens. We were never on TV, we were never anywhere. And if there was an Indian on TV, everyone would go, quick, there's an Indian on telly. So coming from the margins,
Gather around.
Yeah, it's true. I wanted to make us mainstream. I mean, now a lot of people would argue there's too many of us around, but that was my whole point, was to mainstreamise the Asian family. And I think I've done that now with a lot of my work. If you look at EastEnders on Christmas Day and you look at The Family on Channel 4, and around the world, people see Indians as very much part of British culture. And it used to be Merchant Ivory was very British. So given that, so I always try and give you images of the community, my community, in a way you're not expecting. So horror was really the most logical way for me to go.
Did you just use the word mainstreamize?
Yes.
Use it more than once, in fact.
Yes. To mainstream.
I know. I let it pass, but I'm glad you picked it up on it. Because
do you still break a coconut as a kind of a ritual at the start of every film?
Absolutely, yes. It's good luck.
A bit of a tradition.
Yeah, we get all the whole crew comes, all of the crew, everyone comes, and we all gather around whatever the first location is. And my AD is very excited about this guy because he's a bit of an Indophile. And he's Joe Wright's AD, not because he's the right AD. And he stands there and he passes the coconut to me as my AD, and then I stand there and I'll say a big Sikh chant, which is Bole Sonihar, and then I'll go and the coconut smashes and everyone claps.
What does that Sikh chant mean?
It means into the war, let's go.
And if you throw the coconut down and it doesn't smash,
it's bad luck.
And has that ever happened?
No, thank God. That's why you have to make sure.
Now, what would happen in a Neil Marshall version of that traditions that you get the coconut, you smash it into a tree, and blood and it and guts will splash. Absolutely. Do you have a do you have any traditions, Neil, right at the beginning of a
traditionally
film?
Traditionally, chop somebody's head off. Yes. Well, anything.
Do you do anything at the start just because you always have, because you think it'll bring you good fortune?
Nothing of great significance. Usually it involves the crew going out and getting very drunk early on.
Oh,
so that you have that bonding session.
Did you get drunk on mead for Centurion?
We should have done, actually.
Right, so we're going to talk about Centurion, and is it year? It's 119 AD, is it?
117.
117, sorry, a little bit fast forward there.
119 is the sequel.
I don't think a lot of.
No,
lot
it's the other way around, isn't it? AD. No, it's not. No, it's.
Yeah. 2 years out is a Ken Bruceism. So, Gurinder, thank you very much for coming in. So, It's a Wonderful Afterlife is out today.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You should have it as a double bill.
I think we should.
What certificate is it? I didn't notice this one. What certificate is it?
It's the one where everyone can go, and if you're young, you have to go with your mum and dad.
12. I must get the BBFC advice to see what it says about contained scenes of people having been killed with Indian food, and because they, I bet you they have been very specific about why it's a 12. I'll print it up.
Best certification joke was in recent days. Alexander Armstrong, who was presenting Have I Got News for You, was talking about the ghost, and he said the ghost, which is a 15 certificate, that Roman Polanski is sure it was 18. So, Gurinder, thanks very much indeed. So we're going to talk about Centurion in just a moment. We'll update you with the latest travel.
Thank you.
People looking at me saying you shouldn't have done that one.
Anyway, but you did, and it's too late.
I attributed it to Alexander Armstrong, so if that was offensive, that was his fault.
But why would it be offensive? It's only offensive if one does the maths.
On the Lost in Translation theme, Mark in Middlesbrough says, As Good As It Gets was translated as Mr. Cat Poop in Hong Kong. Apparently it came from the name Melvin, Jack Nicholson's character, which is pronounced very similarly to the Cantonese colloquial word for cat poop.
No.
Well, it sounds... I bet that's true.
What, that Melvin means cat poop in Cantonese?
I think he's just clearing that up just a little bit for us.
Okay.
Hope that's making
he's clearing
it clear
up the cat poop
to use the appropriate slogan. So Neil Marshall's new film is Centurion. Tell us about this the film, the historical sweep which you take us through here, Neil.
It's based around the myth of the 9th Legion of Rome, which marched into Scotland or was then Caledonia in 117 AD to fight the Picts and wipe the Picts out. And the myth goes that they marched into the Scotch mist and vanished without a trace, and that's it. So I just wanted to make a story of what might actually have happened to them.
As they walk into the mist.
Yeah.
And it
what
is
was
a myth.
So, what was there so terrible about these Picts that the Hadrian built a 60-mile-long wall to kind of keep them out of the empire. So.
This is, of course, a subject to which you've alluded before, because this is the second film you've made about Hadrian's, about walling off Scotland for reasons of gross brutality.
Yeah, true. It's like two parts of a trilogy of which there is no middle part.
Yeah, but will Hadrian's Wall be? Because I do figure that the way actually what you do is then go, okay, now I'd like to make a movie. I'd like these haircuts. I'd like I'd like Scotland. I'd like Hadrian's Wall in it, and I'd like people hitting each other in the face with axes. What have you got? I know. Let's do Romans.
Yeah,
that'll work.
Do them all. Do them all. Well, growing up in Newcastle, you're kind of in the shadow of Hadrian's Wall, and you can't avoid going on the obligatory school trips to all the Roman forts and stuff like that. So it's kind of been ingrained in my psyche for quite some time.
But it's still a great story, isn't it? I mean, the whole hatred, the whole Picts, Romans to Hadrian's Wall, it's still a magnificent story. But it's a story which people will recognise, isn't it? Because I think they might have seen westerns that have a similar kind of
it's very similar to an old kind of John Ford cavalry movie, and that the Romans are the cavalry and the Picts are like the Apaches. And I guess from that point of view, it's very un-PC because we're telling it from the point of view of the Romans. So. And getting you to sympathise with what is essentially an invading army, and the Picts are defending their homeland. So it's there's a lot of sides to it, which I think keeps it interesting.
But also, it's the gang of people cut off behind enemy lines trying to get back, which we know most recently is the Wanderers, and
it's the Warriors. It's
Warriors.
It's sorry, comfort,
the
stuff
Wanderers,
like that,
the Warriors. Yeah. So, but yes, it's that story.
Yeah,
but it's done with. What people would be expecting from a Neil Marshall film. I mean, what I mean is right from the word go, there is an awful lot of fighting, and people die as a result of fighting with swords, and this is something that you're enjoying telling with buckets of blood.
Brutal honesty is what I call it.
Brutal honesty. Yeah. But with more blood, with more blood than anyone else. So there is one particular fight scene in which every shot is a death shot. You know, there isn't a single, you know, it's not sword play, death. Sword play, death. It's wherever you look, it's the final cut.
David Morrissey did say that at one point, because we saw him shortly after he'd finished, he had the haircut, and we said, "What have you been doing?" He said, "I've just finished working on Centurion." I said, "What was it like?" He said, "It was a Neil Marshall film." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Blood everywhere." He said, "At one point, he had showed one of his family a photograph of himself in the movie, and so covered in blood and filth was he that they did not recognise him as part of their tribe."
Yeah, he was. He was in a bit of a state by the end of it. Yeah.
Take us through the cast, because you've got some notable fighters here.
Well, you've got a fantastic cast. We've got Michael Fassbender, we've got Olga Kurylenko, Dominic West, Liam Cunningham, Noel Clarke, Riz Ahmed. It's just an amazing cast.
And with assorted accents, which I guess works, because if they were speaking in Latin, that would be utterly bizarre.
Well, that's the thing. I came to a decision that I wanted them to sound like the equivalent of a bunch of squaddies, I guess. And so not to have them all speaking like the Queen's English, because, you know, that's as wrong as anything else if you're going to get, you know, pedantic about it. But and we couldn't all have them speaking in Latin either. So I just thought, let's have them speaking in their own, whatever accents they have, just tone it down a little bit so it's not full on. And it's more authentic that way. I mean, people have come back to me and said, oh, well, they wouldn't have swore like that. And so I bet they would, just not those particular words.
Yes. But the meaning, the thrust of the message would have been more or less
the
same.
The point, yeah.
And the Picts speak in a language I imagine that you've just made up for fun, because I don't think we have any Pict.
There is no recorded language for the Picts. So what I've done, so I gather what Kevin MacDonald done with his film as well, Eagle of the Ninth, is that we've both done Scots Gaelic for the Picts. It's like, you know, it's as near as damn it. So
it is Scots Gaelic.
That's what we've used in the film. Yeah.
Do you know what the only film to be released in Scots Gaelic in the past 30 years was? Other than the fact that you've now broken that, Doc?
I don't, actually.
Shack?
Yeah,
which means seven.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
And of course it's
Must
Gaelic.
Missed that one.
It's Gaelic, yeah.
It's Gaelic if it's Irish. Otherwise there'll be letters. And in fact, on that theme, yes. Alan Miller, via a tweet earlier today, why do you always portray the Scots as dangerous and feral?
Well, they are, aren't they?
There you go.
Okay. History is, you know, they kept the Romans out for, you know, 100 years, so they've got to be a little bit dangerous and feral, but I don't consider that to be a negative quality.
What do we know? What do we actually know for certain about the Picts?
Not a lot, really.
So that's great. So no one can say, I think you've entirely misrepresented the way Pict women dress in battle.
Well, supposedly the Picts like to go into battle kind of wearing very little, but we figured this was the middle of winter and it was Scotland, and I don't think that Picts were that stupid. Maybe they did that in the height of summer, but we had a certain amount of artistic license and a certain amount of imagination, and had to kind of go along with that.
And why? How come it is that you know you wait for years and years for one of these movies to come, and then you and Kevin MacDonald, was that completely coincidental? Because I didn't realise that until I was just reading it in the paper today that his movie's about the ninth as well, and that's coming.
Yeah, it's total. I mean, we've been aware of each other's projects for about the past 3 years, and you know, we never knew which one was going to go into production first. As it turned out, we got there like 2 or 3 months before they did, and we're out 2 or 3 months before they are. It's exactly the same thing as what happened with Descent and The Cave, that, you know, two cave projects came along at the same time.
Yeah, the difference there was that Descent was, you know, like, because Descent didn't open until in America until quite a lot afterwards, didn't it?
It opened here before The Cave and in America after The Cave.
And The Cave wasn't much good. I don't seem to remember. Descent was great, but I mean, I haven't seen Kevin MacDonald's movie, obviously. But
Cave,
I mean,
was a disappointment, that's for sure.
Cave was a disappointment. I don't remember it, but I mean, it can't have been as good as The Descent, which was one of the best films of that year, as you know, I think everybody recognises. Descent 2, I have to say, I was disappointed by, because it was just very hard to go anywhere after. It was like the story was complete and was all done, and you know,
I haven't seen it myself. I don't know.
Were you not involved in it at all?
No, I was really, you know, it's just my name on the credits, that's it.
Okay, so not your fault at all then.
Nothing to do with me.
What would be interesting is to get Kevin's Eagle of the Ninth, to get his Ninth Squadron
against
yours, to fight yours. Who do you think would win?
Ours.
How many were actually in your squadron?
Well, it differs throughout the film, doesn't it, really?
It's a few hundred.
Before all the stuff happens, there's a bunch of them, and then afterwards, yeah, there's seven.
There's a few thousand at the start, and then it, you know, kind of.
And then that number
goes down in an Agatha Christie way.
There's a series of.
But I reckon our boys could take theirs easy.
So there's three, but actually, is it considered there were like 3,000 or something like that?
Yeah, there's 3,000 or 4,000 of them.
And then what you do is you kill them off one by one, which is why the film is like 9.5 hours.
We get rid of a big chunk at the start.
It looks fantastic. You filmed it where?
Well, we filmed it up in the Highlands in the Cairngorms in February of last year.
Yeah, it does look cold.
It was -18 on the first day.
There's a scene where the escaping Romans have to go through a river, and they're like body surfing through the rapids, and it looks absolutely freezing, and they all look as though they can't wait to get out of that river as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that was all for real. What you can't see is the snow on the bank side of the side. There's like a foot of snow on the bank side of the side. It was that was a very, very cold river.
And is Butch Cassidy? That, I mean, I saw that as a, isn't that a reference to Butch Cassidy when they have to jump?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing has got it is to me a western.
Yes.
You know, which was the frontier to the Romans was the equivalent of the Wild West. So I kind of put a lot of Western.
But also, you are one of those filmmakers who is very unafraid of reference. I mean, because the last movie you made, Doomsday, was absolutely every other scene. It was like, that's that, and that's that, and that's that. I mean, it's a bunch of movies that I like, as it happens, and I thought you'd put them together, but it is, you know.
Yeah, Doomsday was shameless.
Totally shameless. But you don't have a problem with that at all, do you? That's something you're quite happy to do.
Well, no, I, going into that one, I told everybody that I was making a homage to all that kind of stuff and kind of putting all the best bits of all those 80s movies into one movie. So,
and just to be absolutely
clear, that was the plan.
Your wife was quite happy to have to die by having her eye gouged out.
Yes, she was. I mean, she's evil in the film. Axel Carolyn, she's called, and she shoots so many Romans in the back, it should become a drinking game. You have to have take a shot every time she shoots someone in the back.
Yeah, that sounds as though it already is a drinking game. Neil Marshall is still here to discuss Centurion. Why are you wafting a piece of paper around?
So this is the BBFC Centurion 15 for strong bloody violence within an historical context, including sight of limbs and heads being sliced off, his axe embedded into a character's neck, warrior being hit in the eye with an arrow, sight of a man's torso being hit with a knife during an interrogation, the character having although strong, the injury detail is brief and fleeting, often shown as part of a montage of swiftly edited action. That's why you've got 15. Gurinder Chadha got a 12 for a number of things, including, you know, a woman with a kebab skewer through her neck and a man being killed by the pastry. But it does point out the reason you got a 12 rather than a PG is the scene in which a woman covered in red chutney this is all from the BBC. A woman covered in red chutney uses telekinetic powers to fling food and objects around a room in which a large party is taking place. Younger children would be unlikely to see the joke in this. The scene is a spoof of Carrie, and instead be frightened.
There you go.
Good to know.
More red chutney next time, Neil.
That's right.
Let's play you a clip from Centurion.
I don't think we've got a clip of Centurion, have we? I thought there was a.
Okay,
I'll tell you what, I'll do it.
All right, go on.
I'll do it, go on.
Well, why don't you and Neil act out?
Okay, okay, I'll be Michael Fassbender, okay? And you can be everyone else, okay? Okay, so here we go. So,
I had been travelling for 7 days on foot, followed by the woman with the strange hair and the woad. But I knew I must keep going, for I was...
What's his name?
Quintus Dias.
Quintus Dias. Oh, behind me are some Picts.
That's you. Us, Picts.
Go.
Get out of my country, Roman.
No, in Pict.
I can't do that. It's all on...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because Scots...
Gaelic.
Sounds exactly like Japanese. Where you've done it. Clearly, part of the... You alluded to it just there. That whole superior invader comes in, dominates country full of plucky insurgents. You know, there's a bigger story which you're alluding to.
Is there?
It occurred to me.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the parallels are there.
The Romans say at one stage, this is a new kind of warfare. You know, we're not used to this.
Yeah, the Picts basically kept the Romans at bay for, you know, so long, using essentially guerrilla warfare and terrorist tactics. But I didn't really want to kind of ram that down the audience's throat. It's there. You know, the comparisons are there.
A couple of questions which we asked Gurinder, just because they were issues to be debated. The worst film that you've ever seen, or one of, if you'd be prepared to mention it.
I've seen a lot of bad movies.
Okay,
the worst, the worst one, I don't know. Recently, I'm going to be controversial. I really didn't like Avatar.
Well, there's a lot of people that really don't.
Yeah. And Quantum of Solace really wound me up as well.
Yeah, Question of Sport, yeah.
On that. What was that all about?
No, yeah, who knows?
But, I mean, things like, you know, Mummy 3, you know, G.I. Joe, stuff like that, fairly awful.
Yeah, G.I. Joe was rubbish, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I was going to ask you is about 3D, but I know that there is a 3D project.
You're not doing 3D,
now,
are you?
Because it has the greatest title. It's a Neil Marshall
film.
Not,
are you?
It's a Neil Marshall 3D film. What is the greatest one-word title that you could have for a Neil Marshall film which is going to be done in 3D?
Pickaxe.
You're not far off.
Spear. Ice pick. Chainsaw.
What would happen if you took an...
Impaled.
What would happen if you took an ice pick to somebody's head?
Skewered.
It would...
Splat, Fangoria, what? I don't know.
Should we end
go
it?
On, go on.
Burst.
You are making a 3D film called Burst.
In 3D. I want to see that. I automatically want to see that.
It's about people exploding.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. It absolutely is going to be great.
You know that
and hang on, we haven't finished.
Oh, there's more.
Who are you working with?
It's being produced by Sam Raimi.
There you go. Oh. Sam Raimi, Neil Marshall, Burst 3D. Thank you.
Share your concerns about 3D, so I've got to try and make it good.
So what are you going to do that no one else has done?
Well, apart from exploding people in 3D gratuitously. I don't know. It's so early days yet. We're not going to be filming it for quite a while, and I'm just getting into the whole research of 3D and obviously having to watch a lot of 3D movies as well. Well, I've got to correct a mistake as well. Street Dance was not converted to 3D. It was shot in 3D.
Yeah, no, I think that was... I think Gurinder was saying that I haven't seen Street Dance in 3D, and I leapt in there to have a go at retrofitting.
I think somebody was commenting before saying that Greengrass should never make a 3D movie, but I don't know, I'm quite tempted to try some handheld 3D to see if I can make the audience fairly sick.
That'd be quite fun. But is there something that you think that that you see the technology and you think, I want to be a part of that, I could do something...
Not desperately. I'm not suddenly going to convert everything into 3D. I don't think that's the way it should
what
be used.
What would your touchstone 3Ds be?
Tool, so should be used well. My touch...
Yeah, I mean, which 3Ds would you look at and go, okay, yeah, that was the kind of good 3D that I'm looking for?
To be honest, I haven't really seen that much of it yet. I kind of liked... I thought Beowulf was pretty good. Some of that. Some of the animated movies have really nailed it a lot better than live-action ones have.
Have you seen Flesh for Frankenstein in 3D?
That'd be very good.
I haven't, no.
If you're going to make Burst, there's only a couple of prints of it left. Go and get a viewing of... You've seen Flesh for Frankenstein in 3D. Flesh for Frankenstein in 3D is one of the very, very few films that I would say actually justifies 3D.
Okay, I'll check that out.
And what is next? What comes before Burst, Neil? Anything else?
I don't know. I'm also working on a feature version of the old TV series, The Professionals.
Hey.
Bodie and Doyle.
That'd be good.
Who's in that?
We're not that far down the line yet.
Who would you like to
have? Yeah, go on.
Who would I like to have?
Yeah, go on.
We can
go on. God, at the moment, I would love to...
Deck.
I'd love to get Fassbender back in there somewhere. I think he's fantastic.
He's great.
I don't know who would be the other one yet, though. Not sure.
But which one would he be? Doyle, presumably.
He'd be a perfect Doyle, I think, yeah. I like somebody like Eric Banner for Bodie, maybe.
Okay.
That's very good. Neil Marshall's new movie is Centurion.
In 2D, and it didn't need to be in 3D, nor would it have benefited from being in 3D. Perfectly fine, in good old flat screen.
Neil, thanks very much indeed for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. It's 10 minutes past 3. We'll do some box office top 10 with some reviews to come of the rest of the stuff that is out this week. At number 10, Remember Me.
It's Robert Pattinson. Do you want to? Are you saying for the top 10? Just in case, because he might be the first filmmaker to actually badmouth a film in the top 10.
No, he won't.
Okay, Remember Me, Robert Pattinson, he's a perfectly fine actor. The film is all over the place. It was kind of all right for a while and then ends up with a really, really, badly handled punchline twist at the very end.
Right.
Seen it?
No.
See, this is what it's going to be, but, he might surprise us. You never know. at number 9 is The Blind Side.
It's a Sandra Bullock movie. I like Sandra Bullock very much. The film is a TV movie of the week, essentially, but it is her, it's her Erin Brockovich, and I'm glad that she won the Oscar for it.
Alice in Wonderland, number 8.
There's been some debate about this retrofitted into 3D or not. I mean, the fact of the matter is they shot it in 2D and then afterwards went back and did it in 3D. I wrote a piece about this in The Observer and somebody said, no, that's not true. They designed it in 3D, but they shot it in 2D. I've seen it in 3D and 2D.
So someone disagrees with you. Their argument is characterised as...
Yeah, it's much better in 2D. Have you seen it in either version?
I've seen neither version.
You're so rubbish at this.
Terrible, as all directors are. But it's going to be your blame because it you is, asked him to stay.
Yeah, but it's going to be a standing feature. Let's see if we can get a filmmaker to badmouth something that's actually in the top 10.
Cemetery Junction is at number 7. And while we were off, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant spoke to Colin Patterson, our entertainment reporter, about Cemetery Junction. And Mark, your name came up.
Did it?
How many laughs do you think there will be?
12.
12, I'm hoping for.
Really?
12 laughs over that hour and a half. But there'll be a few tears as well.
Because Mark Kermode's the theory is that 6 laughs makes quite a good comedy. That's twice as funny as a good comedy already.
Oh, OK, they're not 12 then. 5.
Well, yeah, but don't just instantly fold because you heard that Mark Kermode thinks X, Y, Z.
I'm hoping...
The man's favourite film is The Exorcist.
I'm hoping he's going to say this is better than The Exorcist. That's my hope.
I mean, honestly, The Exorcist.
Is it Kermode or Kermode? Because I always thought it was Kermode, but I think he's changed it so it doesn't sound like Kermode. Is it Kermode?
I think it's Kermode, yeah.
So you put the emphasis on the Ker so it doesn't sound like a Kermode.
But don't slag off Kermode. He's a big hitter. You don't want him on your side.
One, I've met him. I like him as a person. I like his films. I like his choices. And dare I say it, I know you're a bigger film geek than him and you're like, oh, I like Japanese films, right? But I like the fact that he chose The Exorcist. He's standing behind his guns and he's saying, that's his reputation on the line there. He didn't choose the obvious ones that no one have seen. It doesn't make sense, obvious, that no one's seen. I like Mark Kermode.
So do I, and I love the fact that he plays in a rockabilly band.
Does he?
Yeah.
Is that why he's got the hair all the time?
I think so.
I was walking down the street the other day, right? This is true. I saw Mark Kermode across the street, right? And I went, Mark! It wasn't him, just another bloke with a quiff. And so he's got Ricky Gervais shouting Mark, like that, and then just looking at him and just running away.
That other bloke loves the film.
Yeah! That other bloke hates The Exorcist and loves Cemetery Junction more.
So there you go.
It was very unusual.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was a slightly surreal moment, but I thought you'd like to hear that.
Well, the interesting thing about Cemetery Junction is, for me, it raises the question of whether or not a comedy has to make you laugh to be a comedy. In fact, I did a blog about exactly this, saying I've always had this thing about five or six laughs, otherwise it doesn't work. In fact, the funny thing with Cemetery Junction is I didn't laugh very much at all, but I do like the film. And I did a thing on the blog, the BBC blog, about whether or not a comedy actually had to make you laugh, or whether I'd been barking up the wrong tree. And several people... But sending several suggestions saying, in fact, you know, that just because something is a comedy, it doesn't have to make you laugh. And I think Cemetery Junction is a good example of this. I mean, there are chuckles in it, but it's not a laugh-out-loud film at all. But I did like it very much.
It's no use asking Neil Marsh about it, because he won't have
seen it.
No.
Slag it off anyway.
Dear M.K., Dr. K., is it Alistair in Glasgow? I went to see Cemetery Junction last night. Absolutely adored it. Funny, touching, looked great, had a fantastic soundtrack. Emily Watson very nearly had me in tears. However, on leaving the cinema, I couldn't help but notice that a common comment from those around me was, well, that wasn't very funny, was it? Which almost had me screaming, well, clearly that wasn't the point. It seems that no matter how fantastic the film is, the is it, isn't it funny enough is an issue for people.
No, but it is very interesting, because that question, if you go and see a film by Ricky Gervais, Steve Merchant, you expect it to become, and I didn't know what to expect at all, and as I said, I do like it. I liked it very much. I thought it was a very, very good character piece, and I really enjoyed it. And it is a comedy, but it's not a laughing comedy.
We're going to bring you the top 6 in just a moment, and on the sure and certain assumption that Neil won't
just show him the list. Show him the list and see whether he suggested jump to them. If there's any of those you've seen,
Clash of the Titans.
Right, okay, Clash of the Titans. Did that quickly, Frank, quickly. Clash of the Titans, what do you think of it?
I thought it was...
rubbish.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. He doesn't have to tell you what to think.
I thought it was a film that wasn't helped in any way by making it in 2 to 3D, and no amount of 3D could make the central performance any more than 1D.
We'll come to all the listener comments about Clash of the Titans, of which there is much, but I think overwhelmingly people think, how is it possible to make that story boring? Which is quite an achievement. Neil, thank you very much indeed. You can go now. You are dismissed. Thank you very much indeed. Neil Marshall's film is Centurion. The Ghost is at number 6. Lots of correspondence about this. You haven't seen The Ghost.
Anyway.
But you also haven't seen Dear John, which we're going to come to. So if anyone can send us a one-paragraph, pithy review of Dear John, and get it to us in the next couple of minutes, we will try and use it.
Yes.
On The Ghostwriter, this is Paul, Dr. Paul from Derby. Dear Tony and Cherie, I've had something troubling rattling around my brain for a couple of weeks, and the only way I know how to relieve my anxiety is to send you a cathartic email. Anyway, he goes on a great length about critical faculty anxiety disorder, which is what he thinks he's suffering from. Anyway, some thoughts from him. Cemetery Junction depicts a view of 70s England only seen in TV rom-coms and dramas at the time, and The Ghostwriter is just a mediocre plodding thriller with bad accents. Clunky dialogue, especially in certain scenes with Ewan McGregor and the Mrs. Brosnan. Ghostwriter isn't that good is it? Or maybe it is, and I'll just accept that I've turned it into a hypocritical, grumpy old man. Lou in Stockholm, just got back from a screening of Roman Polanski's Return to the Silver Screen, an experience that left me thoroughly underwhelmed. Why do Mr. McGregor and Mr. Wilkinson keep squandering their talents in these unengaging so-called thrillers? The sole tantalising aspect of The Ghost is managing to spot every single example of in-your-face product placement, the worst since Casino Royale, along with feeling bad for good old Tom Wilkinson for hopelessly trying to manage an American accent. When the most exciting moment of your film consists of a written note being passed around, you know that your $45 million probably have gone to waste. Glad to see the good doctor is back from the Soviet Union. Keep up the wittertainment. Henry says, love the show, Steve. First time emailer, please be gentle. We went to see Ghost the other day, then listened to Floyd and Boyd reviewing it on last week's podcast. We differed somewhat, and I just wanted a bit of guidance from teacher as to what I should think. Essentially, loved the film, but thought the plot development was occasionally rather plodding and obvious. The story itself was great, but there were times when the script seemed to say almost literally, oh, wow, yes, that's interesting, and is actually really important when you think about it. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, audience. A little bit of the Hardy Boys meet My First Adventure Story by Henry, aged 8. Overall, I did get my £9.75 worth and very much enjoyed the film, but it just bugged me somewhat. We're going to have to wait for your thoughts.
You are. On the subject of
have to pay and go and see it.
£9.75, last night, what is it today, Friday? Last night, because I got back, because I finally got back from, you know, from being
the
stuck.
Soviet Union.
From the Soviet Union, yes. And incidentally, hello to Sean and everyone, for, thank you everybody for being so nice.
Sean, so I had to do, who's Sean?
I was stuck in the former Soviet Union, or Greece as we like to call it now.
Where did Sean come into it?
He's my friend who I made in...
What's that got to do with anything?
Well, it took like 2 seconds for me to say hello because I knew he'd be listening because he was concerned about whether or not I was going to get back in time to do the show. And he helped me to get back. You should say thank you to him. Although actually, of course, maybe not. There was a point to all this, which was... now gone.
Nanny McPhee's at number 5.
Which I really, really like. Emma Thompson can do no wrong in my eyes, and a very fine a sequel that film is too.
Kick-Ass is at number 4. Phil in London asked the good doctor to compare Kick-Ass to the sublime Buckaroo Banzai. I rushed to the cinema, eagerly awaiting a smart and witty take on the superhero genre, only to be rather disappointed. The story, or lack of, was extremely tedious, while the garish MTV visual style called to mind the work of Kevin Smith, and, apologies in advance for speaking his name, McGee. I found Hit Girl to be little more than Scrappy-Doo with a terribly contrived potty mouth bolted on, while I'm shocked that no one has mentioned Nicolas Cage's failed attempt at ham acting, which is normally something he does
without trying.
It
is a very good Adam West impression. What? I don't get that at all.
I wonder if this film has been made by another director, whether there would have been the same level of cliquey backslapping that your podcast listeners have had to endure over the past 2 weeks.
Hang on, sorry, cliquey backslapping, well, we're not connected to any of the makers of that film, are we?
No, I don't think so. I think it's podcast listeners. Anyway, number 3
Who's the clique?
It's Sean.
Oh, Sean. Oh, I see. Fine. So it's his fault.
From ancient Greece.
From ancient Greece.
How to Train Your Dragon at number 3.
I mean, you know, in 3D. But actually, the film's rather good fun, and it's got much more sort of exciting flying sequences than perhaps some of the other big romping blockbusters out there, like Clash of the Titans, which, incidentally, in Greece is called Titan Maximus.
Which is a better title.
Yeah, in 3D.
Jonathan, Geordie Exile in Nottingham, took my brother, sisters and 11-year-old cousin Holly to see How to Train Your Dragon at a multiplex cinema in Coventry. Considering that this was to be my first 3D film, I was nervous. Imagine my surprise then when we found that this particular multiplex didn't have a 3D screen.
Hooray!
I was quietly pleased about this anyway, telling Holly that seeing it in 3D would not add anything to her experience of watching the film. She was sceptical. 15 minutes into the film, she turned to me and said, this would be amazing in 3D. However, by the end of the film, we were all in agreement that this was one of the best kids' films of recent years. My younger sister Sophie was in tears, and Holly turned to me and said, it didn't really matter if Toothless was in 3D or not, he's still cute. If an 11-year-old can see 3D for what it is, a gimmick, says Jonathan, why are we still being fed 3D nonsense at our cinemas?
Very good. I should say that a couple of kids who I know who have read the source of How to Train Your Dragon have complained that the film is nothing like the source, and the character of Toothless is completely different, and they are fundamental. And that may that clearly that is entirely correct. I mean, I haven't read the source books, but as the film as a standalone thing worked very well.
Clash of the Titans is number two. You might like to know that Chelsea manager Carlo Ancelotti says he's going to the cinema to watch Clash of the Titans rather than watching Manchester United against Spurs tomorrow.
Very good.
He's going to be disappointed, I believe.
They did a a test on... well, not a test. They started that Sky 3D sports channel in which they've been playing Premiership matches. They did... Was it Chelsea? I don't know. Chelsea against the All Blacks or something. No, because I did a piece in about, and the general feeling was that watching sports matches in 3D is just complete rubbish. And you know, so once again, that was happening at the same time as Clash of the Titans was opening in 3D, and apparently it was a pretty much headache experience whether you stayed in the pub to watch the football or you went out to watch Titan Maximus or whatever it's called.
Mark Hudson in Newcastle upon Tyne. Though I have not shelled out any of my hard-earned pennies to go and see Clash of the Titans, I did catch a trailer which featured the remarkably pedestrian tagline, "Titans will clash." Though the film will unlikely, which we might have guessed from the title, though the film will unlikely garnish any BAFTA or Oscar nods, save perhaps for the special effects, it would surely sweep the board in the Stating the Bloomin' Obvious Awards. Other possible nominees: Nerds will have their revenge, The Jedi will return, Mr. Ripley will display some sort of talent. And you know the suspects?
Yes.
Well, they're the usual
ones.
So if you want to join into that, that could be quite fun. Actually.
That would be very good.
Yeah, movie slogans that actually state the obvious. Titans will clash.
Titans will clash.
In Clash of the Titans.
Incidentally, just...
85058.
Usual suspects. You know where that comes from, don't you? This is one of the most well-known bits of movie trivia. You know where the phrase, round up the usual suspects, comes from.
I don't know. What?
Come on. You do know this.
Dickens. The Bible.
No,
Shakespeare.
Not Dickens.
Japanese horror movies.
In which movie does the guy say, right, round up the usual suspects?
Is it Casablanca?
Yes! Did they just say that in your earphones? You can see it came into your head from the control room.
I haven't seen Casablanca.
You have so much not got a Lady Gaga poker face.
Right. Anyways, Dear John at number one.
You got a review?
Nope. I did ask for it.
I was leaving in 3 minutes to do the review so you could do it.
That's because all the staff who were busy shouting Casablanca at me didn't bring in a Dear John review. No one has sent one in.
Okay.
No one has
sent one. Well, no one's gone to see it, despite the fact that it's number one.
So clearly it's a suspect number one because no one has gone to see it.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
Hands up in anyone in there seen it?
How about we don't do anything now? We just stay here until we get a Dear John review.
Okay.
How long do you think it's going to be? There's a thing about silence.
You've lost your nerve already.
There's a certain amount of silence after which a transmitter actually shuts down.
In Radio 1, it was something like 6 seconds. If Sting stopped singing for 6 seconds, the sound of Freebird or something started automatically. Because otherwise...
That's a very old Radio 1 you're talking about.
It is very... Because otherwise all the transmitters go into shutdown and it takes 15 minutes to charge them back up again, right? So you can't have more than 6 seconds.
How much silence can we have on 5 Live before the transmitters? 90 seconds.
Casablanca, apparently, they said in your head.
No, 90 seconds, they said.
90 seconds. Should we try?
Well... Okay, what we want is a review of Dear John, otherwise we don't go on. I'm going to lose my...
You lost your nerve first.
Well, what am I supposed to do? People all over the BBC, people going, what?
What?
You can't be silent. It's against the law.
And it's just...
It's gone there! You see, you should have just sat it out. The gag would have been so much better. Can we re-edit it for the podcast? Actually have 30 seconds of silence to make it sound like he had the guts to do it, all right?
Paul in Leeds. Dear John, in a sentence, what is it exactly you're undecided about? What have you got?
What? So
now, normally that wouldn't have been brought in on the grounds that it was rubbish. Dear John review. Dear John... Dear God, says Andy Swanson.
Okay.
Well, that was an entertaining feature. So, that's the top 10 in a minute and a half.
No, let's go early to the news.
You can't go early to the news because some people are doing other things and they tune in.
They're not interested in us. They just want
for
Justine.
The news.
Fill in 90 seconds of something.
Shall I start reviewing? Okay, so I'll start in that case reviewing Date Night. Okay. So, Date Night, which is the new movie with Steve Carell and Tina Fey. And Tina Fey is... apparently, Steve Carell and Tina Fey were on the show last week. I wasn't in here last week. As you know, I was under the Volcano Club. Were you in?
I was in.
And were they funny and witty and intelligent? Did they say lively jokes?
jolly things.
Yeah, they're very good.
Okay, so the story, I'm just going to set the story up. We'll have to do the review after the news, so obviously I've got about 70 seconds for it. So the story is, they are an average, everyday, ordinary, slightly boring suburban couple. And what's happened is that their lives have reached that point whereby they are no longer seeing each other as, you know, exciting people to be. They've fallen into being just effectively good roommates. And they never have any intimate time together anymore. But they do have this regular ritual, which is that they go out on date night. And they go out on date night and they go to the local restaurant. They always order the same thing. They always drink the same wine. They don't have pudding because they're just, frankly, a little bit too tired to do it. But all that is about to change because on this particular date night, Tina Fey says, I want to go to this particular restaurant, which is very, very hard to get into. And he says, okay, fine. You know what? I'm going to take you to the restaurant. They get to the restaurant. They say, can we get a table? Say, can you get a table? No, you can't have a table because the restaurant is fully booked for months. But then they overhear. Party for two, triple horn. Party for two, triple horn. Party for two, triple horn. They're not going to be... So Steve Gray goes, we're the triple horns. And they take the triple horns table. And boy, does that turn out to be a bad move. 6 seconds to go. Come on, that's not bad.
That's good. No, thank brilliant. You. I'm not arguing.
Dear John, this is...
Oh, no! I've just talked it up to half past. Don't now interrupt. I've just filled for 90 seconds. Do the news and do that after.
Mick says, dear John, watch the trailer save money. And Howard says, good fellow, good-looking fellow, mumbles a lot. Blonde smiles and cries. Bombs in the middle. What was the point? That is now the end of that. Remember, you're just the contributor. Okay.
But the Sonny nominated contributor.
That's right. Sonny nominated specialist contributor.
The qualifications are getting more and more, aren't they?
The field narrows. So we're nicely teed up then.
For date night. Should we have the clip from date night? So this is the clip from before they go to the restaurant. This is kind of what's happened to their married life.
Oh. Oh, what? No. You just put in your mouth guard. That usually means we're not going to.
No. We could still fool around.
Only if you're into it. I mean...
No, I would love to. Let me just, get the buzz.
Yeah, okay, you know what? No, it's... Honey, I'm totally fine if we don't.
No, I just, I would love to. Let me just get my head around it.
Okay. It's totally cool if we don't.
Are you sure? Mm-hmm. Because those potato skins made me kind of gassy.
Let's just do a rain check.
Okay. Are you sure?
I will light up your life next time.
So... basically, the feeling in advance was that anything with Steve Carell and Tina Fey together, you know, was going to be huge. It's like it's the idea of putting together two, you know, great big, you know, comedy stars, and the result's going to be huge. Here's the interesting thing about Date Night, and I noticed that it's the reviews have been, shall we say, mixed, middling, you know, changeable. Some of them not good at all. At the beginning of it, there's a really nice little comedy starting up, which is the story of this, you know, this couple who've, you know, lived together and got into that kind of routine. It's rather well played. It's done sort of fairly naturalistically. There are laughs and, you know, but they're sort of, you know, smiles and chuckles rather than belly laughs. And there's a very nice established relationship that they're a couple who've lived in each other's pockets for such a long time. They try to do this date night thing that tries to get them out and gives a little bit of zing, but they don't really have the energy to do it. Okay, and then what happens is the movie essentially goes off in a tangent, which is we've seen before in things like Into the Night, the John Landis movie, which for my money is the best of all John Landis's movies, or After Hours, the Martin Scorsese movie, in which basically people go off into an evening in which one event leads to another, and they go from a situation of, you know, domestication and suburban ordinariness thrown into a completely different world. In this particular case, what it is that they've got the Triple Horns table, and it turns out that there are people after the Triple Horns because they want a zip drive which has got some pictures on it, which is connected to a crime, which is connected to the police station, which is connected to the mayor, blah, 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 one thing leads to another. And next thing you know, you're in the middle of a series of car chases down through the streets of New York, including a car chase in which there's a sports car pushing a taxi backwards, and the two cars are chasing, you know, welded together in the middle. And here's the problem. At the beginning, because the stuff about the relationship between Steve Carell and Tina Fey's character is rather well drawn and is rather funny and is rather charming, as the action takes over, the interest sort of loses. It's very odd. It's like... they kind of didn't have... It's either that they didn't have faith in the relationship itself, so therefore felt they had to simply crank everything up, which is a very John Landis thing to do. And John Landis sometimes gets it right and sometimes gets it wrong. I mean, I do think there are whole sections of the Blues Brothers in which it's just one car crash after another just ceases to be funny. But or that they had a movie that was basically about people getting involved in a crime thing by going to the wrong table at a restaurant. Have you ever had that thing when you arrive at an airport and there are people carrying boards, you know, that say taxi for Mr., you know, in, let's say, you know, Mr. Computer Drive or something, okay? And you think, you know, you there's...
Just to pick a surname at random.
Yeah, you just think you could go up to them and say, yes, I'm Mr. Computer Drive. And you get into the car and see where you go, okay? Somebody presumably has made a movie based on that. But that idea about you sit in the wrong table, I'm sure they have, but if they haven't, my copyright. You sit at the wrong table in a restaurant and somebody mistakes you for somebody. There's a joke going on for a long time about the fact that the Triple Horns can't really be called the Triple Horns. So why are they called the Triple Horns? Well, it's probably an homage to the famous actress Jean Triplehorn, you know, from Basic Instinct.
I'm still trying to work out Mr. Computer Drive and how that surname, of all the thousands that were
because I was looking at the back of a computer and I couldn't think of any other surname. I'm sorry, that was just the thing that came to mind, Mr. Computer Drive.
Hi, I'm Brian Computer Drive.
So basically what happens is that there are two warring elements. There's the thing about the couple, you know, which I think was funny and charming and sweet and rather well judged. I think Tina Fey is great, and actually I thought Steve Carell did it pretty well. I mean, I think they were well patched. And then there's all the action stuff and all the adventure stuff, which is just total baloney. There are, within that total baloney, individual elements which raise a chuckle. They keep regularly going back to Mark Wahlberg's house because Mark Wahlberg was a client of hers, and they keep needing the kind of assistance that only somebody with specialist knowledge could get. And the gag is, every time they turn up at Mark Wahlberg's house, he opens the door and he hasn't got his shirt on. Of course, you know, Marky Mark, you know, with the washboard chest and the, yeah, you know, the six-pack and the thing. And the gag is... The six-pack and the washboard he's, yeah, got, and the whole, you know, and the whole tumbler dryer on his shoulders. And the gag is that essentially, Steve Carell's character feels completely intimidated and threatened by the fact that Mark Wahlberg is walking around without his shirt. And they do that gag three times, and every time they do it, it still manages to be funny. But none of it is as funny as the stuff of the central couple just sitting at a table in a restaurant, being sort of too tired to really have a joke together, and yet wanting to have a joke together. So it was a really bizarre thing. It's not a terrible movie. I had been told quite bad things about it, and I went in, therefore, with fairly low expectations. And I thought there were some things in it that were really charming and really genuinely funny and really sort of seemed to work, and yet they were totally sidelined the minute the action started up. And all the action, all the chasing, all the stuff with the police, all the stuff with the crime, all that kind of comedy just does not work and isn't very funny at all. So it is half a good movie, but I saw it with David Braithwaite here. I'm just gesturing to who is.
It's radio, Mark. No one knows that you're gesturing.
They do now, because it's like the seventh week that I've said this. 26 quid for the two of us. That was the most expensive date I've been on in ages. 26 quid for the two of us to see Date Night. And I really did
see. Is he a friend of Sean's?
He probably is, yes. I'm sure they'd get on very well. But, you know, if Sean had come along, it would have been 39 quid,
you
frankly.
Should mention everyone,
and I do
that, you know,
feel that we would have been substantially underlaughed for the price of 39
pounds.
Why don't
you mention everyone that you've met on holiday in Czechoslovakia, Soviet Union, Rhodesia, and
Pete, Stella?
All of them.
You know, some people, I mean, I can't, yeah, no, but I, don't start me, because I actually will. But so there is somewhere in that central relationship a nice little movie. Sadly, that's not what the rest of the movie gets completely run over by the fact. And if you compare it to Into the Night, which really does this a lot better, because Into the Night does manage to keep the gags going, even as Jeff Goldblum's character is swept into this world of crime. Or in the case of After Hours, it just gets darker and nastier and grimier. And of course, After Hours, they change the ending in the end, but it's After Hours is one of those movies, a classic example of a comedy which you don't laugh, you just kind of wince.
We're now sort of overwhelmed by Dear John reviews.
Okay.
All too late. Anyway, Ian in Brixton, it's utterly awful. I would rather have actually gone to fight in the wars that are portrayed on the screen than sit through that painfully disastrous movie. I took my sister, a fan of any old chick flick, and even she couldn't stand it. So as the reviews go, it's not being particularly enthusiastic, but it is still the number one movie, so it's doing fine. What else is new?
OK, so on that same subject of couples being the centre of a comedy, there's this new film, Extract. You know, I kept saying extract, as in yeast extract. As in root beer extract.
It's
the flavouring. No, extract would be the verb. Extract is the noun, so it's extract the noun. And I kept saying all the way when we were coming up through, I kept saying Ben Stiller. I didn't mean Ben Stiller, I meant Ben Affleck. I'm sorry, my head is still in 1970s Czechoslovakia, so that's why I was saying Ben Stiller. I meant Ben Affleck.
Is that how he's known in Czechoslovakia?
What?
Never mind.
Ben Stiller.
Yeah,
he, that's the translation. That's the Czechs. They say in Czech. They say in Czech and Slovak. They say Ben Stiller when they mean Ben Affleck.
We have a couple of listeners in Prague, and when you put out that you were going through Czechoslovakia, that one of the people that said actually that country hasn't existed for 19 years is Peter in Prague. Hello to Peter.
Hello, Peter in Prague.
If he's listening, and he spent the whole day walking around Prague looking for you. He said he was on Kermode alert.
I never got out of the airport.
Well, there was an entire
my bags
of time,
did.
Then.
If I tell you, if he's walking around the streets, if you see my bags,
how would you recognise a bag? Is it in the shape of a big double bass?
Yeah, no, because I didn't take my double bass on holiday with me.
How disappointing!
Even for cheap comedy potential,
the Greeks must have been so sad about that.
Jason Bateman is one half of a.
Do the Greeks do skiffle?
I'm sure they do skiffleotolus. Actually, we went to a the guy who had, owned the house that we were living in,
it's a Greek skiffle themed restaurant.
Yes. Invited us round to his house for dinner, right? And he did. They produced the very strong drink, and then he smashed plates, and then his son played the bouzouki.
Good, nice anecdote. Anyway, what else is new?
Yeah, I'm doing what is new. I keep getting put off. Extract, in which Jason Bateman plays one half of a similarly married couple who also have reached that same point in their relationship when they are just good roommates, but no longer having the exciting life that they had before, and both decide. And so, essentially,
who is this?
Extract with Jason Bateman.
You sure it's Jason Bateman?
I'm sure it's Jason Bateman. And he's the barman that he goes and tells his troubles to is Ben Affleck, pronounced in Czechoslovakia.
Statham.
Ben Stiller. And so the barman says to him, he says, oh, you know, this is terrible. It's called Extract because he runs a business that does extracts for flavourings, okay? And he goes to the barman and he says, oh, my life is, you know, me and my wife don't anymore. And he says, what you need to do is hire a gigolo to have an affair with your wife. That will take the guilt off you so then you can have an affair. So he gets this idiot to go and say, go and attempt to seduce my wife. Next thing, the idiot does. And then it also... So it's, again, it's one of those things that starts out kind of deadpan, kind of okay, kind of funny little observations about, you know, families and people and things, and then just loses the plot midway and it has to go off into this. And you think the gag that you think there's a gag, which is that the guy, the gigolo that he gets to go off and seduce his wife, comes straight back and says, yes, I did it, no trouble. And he says, really? And you think, well, the gag is he's seduced the wrong guy. The guy's seduced the wrong girl. No, that's not the gag. The gag is he has seduced the guy's wife and he is having a relationship with her. And then he goes back to the bar and then some more stuff happens. But it's one of those things. There are a couple of nice little moments in it, but nothing more than that. And if you want to see it, you wouldn't miss anything by seeing it on DVD. But if you want to see that movie, essentially, Date Night is the bigger version of it with more car crashes and more... But they are essentially a similar thing, which is, you know, middle-aged couples looking for some way of spicing things up. And unfortunately, after 5 minutes, thinking, OK, we've run out of mileage with that, what should we do? Oh, I know, let's throw in a gigolo. I know, let's throw in a car chase. I mean, that's the problem. It's that neither of the comedies have the strength of their convictions, which is to be a comedy about a middle-aged couple.
On the subject
like you and me.
Of our favourite game at the moment, which is inspired by Titans Will Clash, being the slogan for Clash of the Titans. This is just what's coming, so this might be quite fun. I think you should probably spill over till next week. Stating the obvious taglines is Ted in London, Mission Impossible. He has a mission, it won't be easy. Star Trek, theirs was a journey in space. Dams will be busted. Man inspired by a bat. This is Hugh. Obvious taglines reminds me of my friend who couldn't enjoy There Will Be Blood because she didn't like the tension of knowing that there would be blood. Dave suggesting Mary. There's something about her. So, obvious taglines will work, I think, for a little bit longer. What do you have? It's this Todd Solondz thing.
Life During Wartime, do you feel my Todd Solondz, who, again, as I said, raises the question about whether or not comedy has to make you laugh. Todd Solondz made a big splash with Welcome to the Dollhouse years ago, and then Happiness was, I think, the thing that really sort of put him on the map. And Happiness was a classic case of... I mean, Todd Solondz's entire métier seems to be that sort of screaming, awful, agonising howl of pain that is, in fact, when once removed, slightly satirical and sarcastic. Remember that thing that people always said about, you know, postmodernism means never having to say you're sorry? If you're arch about something, that you somehow deal with things in a way that's disengaged, that's separated. And one of the things that Todd Solondz's films do is they deal with really dark subjects. They deal with, you know, all manner of bizarre sexual perversion. They deal with child abuse. They deal with, you know, but in a way which is very, very arch and very, very uncomfortable. Now, when he made Happiness, there was a lot of kind of, it was a very peculiar
peculiar film to watch, because there were things in it that were sort of, you know, creepily funny, but you'd not laugh funny, but just weird and strange. Now what he's done is he's revisited the characters. Let me read you exactly what he says. He says 10 years have passed between the events of Happiness and Life During Wartime, which is the new film, which revisits those characters, but each one is now played by a different person. He says, I prefer not to be beholden to the literalness of time or circumstances. I like to tweak things and get stuff from a fresh angle. For example, some characters have aged 5 years, some have aged 20 years. Some histories have been altered. I have allowed race not to be something set in stone. Of course, it's completely different cast. It's much more fun and interesting that way. So basically, this has a tangential relationship to Happiness, although there are clear through lines. I mean, a character who went into prison in the first film comes out of prison in the second film. Characters that we met in the first film are revisited in the second film, but in, you know, completely different forms. And actually, if you look, for example, at a film like Palindromes, this is territory that's visited before. But the interesting thing about Life During Wartime is that once again we get a series of vignettes of totally dysfunctional relationships, and some of which are very funny. I mean, Ali Sheedy, who I like very much and haven't seen very much of it in the movies recently, has one scene in which she plays this completely ghastly, self-obsessed, horrible character who is just totally loathsome, and yet her loathsomeness is funny in a comic way. But for most of the film, which we follow Shirley Henderson's character, Shirley Henderson is ironically named Joy, who is being pursued by the ghost of her dead partner, played by Paul Rubens, who of course is more, I mean, it's funny, they do a little thing in the press notes here, they describe who everybody is in one sense. They say Paul Rubens appeared opposite Johnny Depp in Blow. Well, because Paul Rubens is best known as Pee Wee Herman, surely that would still be the thing that you'd say. That's who Paul Rubens is. Wouldn't you say that?
I'm not sure what I'd say on that.
Something. Okay, or it says, you know, Ali Sheedy starred in the acclaimed independent film High Art and The Breakfast Club. Mm, yeah, fine. And then Charlotte Rampling is the star of the classic film The Night Porter. It seems odd to reduce Charlotte Rampling's role to that. Anyway, but so you get these vignettes and you get these series of interactions between people who are all fundamentally really miserable and fairly messed up and searching for some form of happiness which they haven't achieved. And you watch them and there are some moments in it in which you kind of titter and you sort of laugh in an uncomfortable way. Most of the time you sort of wince because it's really painful and weird and twisted. But oddly enough, it also is on a deeper level about forgiveness, which is the one thing that Happiness itself wasn't. So it's like, it's almost like a remix to some extent of Happiness, like a different take on Happiness. It's dealing once again with those same issues, but in a way in which there is an underlying theme of forgiveness, even if that theme doesn't actually blossom into something which is, let's say, warm or redemptive. It is underlying, and I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to, because I've become sort of quite tired of Todd Solondz recently, and I thought this was, at the same time as being a difficult watch, it had a lot. I mean, Shirley Henderson is absolutely great in it. Alison Janney is really, really good in it. Charlotte Rampling is, you know, her usual extraordinary self. Paul Rubens is a quite haunting presence. All those things are in place. And it is rather too arch for its own good, but there is something underneath all that. And it's a brisk 95 minutes long and, you know, well written. And actually, I have to say, beautifully shot. It looks a really beautiful film to look at in an odd way.
But too arch is a rare criticism.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know, there is a certain degree of arch detachment that after a while becomes a little bit troublesome, but it's no more than troublesome. And to be honest, I think that he wouldn't get away with what he gets away with were it not so arch. We should now, because we've only got 7 minutes left, also say that at the beginning of the programme, obviously, we had Neil Marshall in talking about Centurion, and we had Gurinder Chadha in talking about It's a Wonderful Afterlife. And, you know, my feeling about those two films is, in the case of Wonderful Afterlife, it's funny because what Gurinder Chadha, you ask Gurinder Chadha, you know, what films she really doesn't like, and what she said was, actually, I don't mind anybody telling me any story, but what I need is for the story to be told well, to be well structured. Funnily enough, the thing about Wonderful Afterlife is, I thought it was all over the place. I mean, it was quite bafflingly all over the place. I should point out that I had been travelling for a long time, and I saw it in a cinema in which there were other people in the cinema who were...
Really? That must have really upset
you. No, let me finish the sentence. Other people in the cinema who were laughing at the jokes and enjoying it in a kind of crazy sort of way. I did really struggle to get a handle on it. I mean, I really did think, I can't follow where this film is. Is it a horror spoof? Is it a culture spoof? Is it a comedy? Is it a rom-com? Is it a... You know, what is it trying to be? There are a couple of laughs in it for me, but not much more than that. I do think that that its heart is, you know, in the... She said that thing about, you know, so if a filmmaker is well-intentioned, you sort of... you forgive them an awful lot. I do think the film is all over the place, and I think that it's structurally, it's very interesting that the first thing she said was, what she wants is for a story to be well told and for it to be told in the manner of the story. I mean, I have to say, I was sideswiped by it, and I didn't get it. In the case of Centurion, I like Neil Marshall's films very much, and I actually enjoyed the, you know, blokes running around doing a very straightforward story, which, I mean, you and I were talking about this before, and you said, well, you know, where's the character development? Well, I think there is a character development in Michael Fassbender's character, in that, you know, it's the standard heroic character development. But what I liked about it was the fact that Neil Marshall is essentially taking on that epic subject matter, doing it on what I bet you is a fraction of the budget that most other people would do it on, making it look stylish. The standard Neil Marshall thing about, you know, in his movies, doesn't matter whether you're male or female, the characters are all as deadly as each other, and of course actually the female characters, because he's famous for doing The Descent, which was, you know, known as the Chicks with Picks movie. So he has a completely gender non-specific agenda when it comes to who chucks the best spears.
Now there are chicks who are picked.
Chicks are picked. That's very good. I don't know why I didn't think of that, except that because I'm tired. So
that's right, because of course, if you'd been on top form, you'd have thought of it first.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But I enjoyed it, and I liked the spectacle of it, and but Noel Clarke's got a smaller role in it than I would have liked, because I'd liked Noel Clarke very much. But I thought it was a good fun. I don't think it's Neil Marshall's best film, but I think it demonstrates that he is a really good, you know, genre director who understands how to put tab A into slot B and make the thing progress and go for it. And the battle
scene. The thing is with this is that in this film, tab A is always a big sword.
And slot B is the other person.
Is the other person's stomach.
That is entirely true.
Can you guess the film from the obvious tagline that have been provided now by listeners? How many more films do we have, by the way?
No, I'm done.
You're done. Okay, right. Well, so I have to make these few texts last for the final 3.5
No, minutes. I was romping to get that out of the way so we did actually get some. You saw Century. I know you haven't seen It's a Wonderful Afterlife. I mean, as I said, it's weird. I'd like to hear what other people thought of It's a Wonderful Afterlife. I mean, as I said, I should confess to the fact that I was tired, but I was completely confused and baffled, thinking, where's it going? I couldn't get the tone of it. So I'd like to hear what anybody else thought. What did you think of Centurion?
It was quite fun. Unfortunately, I watched it with a... because you get these watermarked DVDs, which had...
You get these watermarked DVDs?
Well, because that was the way I got to see it. So, and it had, across the screen, in huge letters, Pathé International. So everything was viewed, never mind the fog that the ninth had to walk through. They were to walk through these letters that said Pathé International all the way through. I thought it was good fun, but it was hard to care very much about who got chopped by whom.
All right,
I would say.
Okay, I did quite care about the fast.
Just more careful and loving and
Quintimus Dingtimus or whatever his name was.
So can you guess the films then from these obvious taglines? Sent in by assorted people. Phil in King's Winford.
Yeah.
A man called Zhivago is a doctor.
Very good.
She's female. She has a tank.
She's Tank Girl.
That's Robert in Manchester.
Are you asking me this? Am I just not meant to leave a blank?
Because it's kind of vaguely rhetorical.
Okay, fine. Vaguely rhetorical.
Neil in Bristol. They have a job. It's in Italy. I like these. who's this? This is Brian. He had a life, didn't he? The Bone Collector tagline was apparently, he collects bones. It can't have been that. Rich in Leeds. The kid does karate. There are all sorts of obvious taglines. So, we've got to move on the week.
Let me read you very quickly.
Don't tell me there's another movie that
The one thing I didn't
yet.
The one thing that I didn't get to see was The Joneses. I was able to get through six, but I didn't get to see The Joneses. This is the paragraph from Nigel Floyd's review, and he said this would have been the film of the week if I'd been able to get into it. Every now and then, a small, intelligent, quietly thoughtful film, thought-provoking film slips through the Hollywood studio's net and prompts the thought, how did this ever get made? The Joneses is one such movie, a welcome surprise in an American entertainment industry dominated by vacuous 3D spectacle, rom-com, wish fulfillment and by-numbers action movies. Topical, funny and gently subversive, this deserves to be a sleeper hit. That's Nigel Floyd's review of The Joneses. For me, film of the week, Centurion.
A very interesting and controversial choice.
No, why?
Well, because I just disagreed with you.
Oh, okay. Oh, fine. It's controversial between you and me, and it's controversial. Yes, controversy or controversy.
But I did enjoy it. I mean, it is a kind of a it's like 633 Squadron, but in a Roman uniform.
Yes,
everyone is going to get it.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online
bbc.co.uk/5live.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.